All right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? Yeah. All right. Triple Play Thursday coming up later on in the show. Get some live music in studio. We're going to find out, would Esmeralda buy that, which is always one of our favorite segments. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But right now, here on the Nick DiGilio show, which I didn't mention, that's what this is. We're here 2 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. One of my favorite guests comes in every couple of weeks to talk TV. Dan Feinberg, who's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We were lucky enough to have an extra visit with him this month. Last week, the Emmy nominations were announced, so Dan was kind enough to join us to talk about that. Now, it's his regular appearance. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan to the show. Hey, Dan.
So much TV to talk about, Nick.
Yes, absolutely. Before we get to some of the newer stuff, I really enjoyed the best and worst 2016 debate that you did with your colleague Tim Goodman.
We like doing those debates. They're fun. We wish we could sort of find time to do them more often, but they're a good way for us to butt heads a tiny bit, agree a tiny bit, you know, to sort of go over ideas in our heads.
It's a fun read, I got to tell you. Well, let's talk about where we are. You know, we did last week or 2 weeks ago, my colleagues Eric Childress and Colin Suter, who review movies with me every Monday morning on the show, we did our halfway through best and worst films lists. And so let's talk a little bit about where you stand on 2016 in the world of TV so far. How did that go for you?
This is fantastic because it's yet another chance for us to talk about various projects involving O.J. Simpson.
Yes, it is.
Like we have been doing all year long every week, which is great fun because, again, that, so far it's been the year of O.J.
Well, you know, I agree with you, Dan. I think the two best things I've seen on television all year by far were The People versus O.J. Simpson on FX, but the Made in America documentary is just astounding.
And that's for me, too. So Made in America is, without any question, the ESPN documentary is currently my number one thing of the year, and I would anticipate it will end the year that way unless something fantastic comes up, in which case, hey, that's fantastic.
Right.
Nothing makes me happier than the idea that there might be something better than something that I loved. I think probably People versus O.J., the FX miniseries, is sort of going to be, who knows, middle of my top 10, bottom of my top 10. It could get pushed up. I can imagine that. But, yeah, there's been a lot of very good stuff this year, but those two O.J. projects kind of dominate everything, both because of the topical similarities, but also just because of how they're the kind of thing where you think, okay, it's an overlap where I don't need both of these things. I might not need either one of these things. And it turned out we needed both of them.
Yeah. You know, I was astounded that your colleague has not caught up with OJ yet. I just couldn't. How did you allow that to happen?
Well, A, I have limited power over Tim Goodman, which is probably for the best. But B, no, it's the thing where because we're splitting stuff up, there's a lot of the stuff that he's reviewed that I haven't gotten to. Maybe not a lot, but there certainly is stuff. You know, Happy Valley, the Netflix series, the first season, I loved the first season of that show. The second season premiered. It was a Tim review. I just haven't been able to get to it.
It's
not that I don't think it's probably awesome, because it was last season. Just I have to get to my own stuff, and I feel like it's the same with him. And that's only a six-hour series with these two things. It's two 10-hour series,
yeah.
So I have some pity for Tim on that. I do hope he watches them in the months to come, just before we get to December and it becomes time to really dig into the year.
Right. Well, let me throw out some titles that I've enjoyed this year. I loved Love, and speaking of Netflix, I also loved Lady Dynamite, and I thought the second season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was very good. Do you agree with those?
I haven't finished Lady Dynamite or Kimmy Schmidt, so I liked the parts of both seasons that I watched. I liked Love. I didn't love Love, and I like saying Love and Love anyway.
Yeah.
There's no way that's going to be an amusing Who's on First line. But yeah, no, those are good things. And eventually I'm going to finish Lady Dynamite because I have the feeling that could be, that could be high on my list. Netflix has so much stuff.
I know. Speaking of Netflix, we want to talk in a couple of minutes here about Stranger Things. We absolutely have to talk about it. But what else? What else is? Do you think are some of the best and worst of 2016? What else?
Well, you know, if we're sticking with Netflix for a little bit more, I thought this Orange Is the New Black season was terrific. I thought last Orange Is the New Black season was fantastic as well. Last year was the first time that Orange Is the New Black hadn't made my end of the year top 10, and I don't know if it will this year. But you know, it was a really great season that ended with rather impressive power. The whole run of HBO Sunday Night shows that just ended, from Game of Thrones to Silicon Valley to Veep to last week's Tonight with John Oliver, all of those were varying degrees of very good to excellent to sublime.
Yeah, so, I'm not a Game of Thrones guy, but I'm not a Game of Thrones guy. But those other three, I loved. I thought they were great seasons.
It was a very good Game of Thrones season following after a somewhat down season last season. Then there are the sort of the cable prestige standbys. So Better Call Saul had a great second season. The Americans had yet another excellent season, and finally got, as we talked about last week, the Emmy recognition it hadn't gotten before that. And right. There are sort of a bunch of things that are fresh and new, and that includes Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, which is great. It includes WGN's Underground, which is really bracing and exciting. It includes Sundance Has Happened, Leonard, which I kind of forget about because it was only six episodes.
Yeah,
really good six episodes.
I was reminded of it when I read your piece about how much I liked it. Seriously, it kind of slipped my mind, but it was terrific.
And that is, it is undoubtedly the kind of thing that's just going to get forgotten, or, you know, just because it's a little thing. And it was a little pulpy character study, which was exactly what it was supposed to be, and it was done well. So that's good. What else?
Baskets.
Of course. We we love talking about Baskets. Yes. Here. Everyone should watch Baskets. And, you know, again, if you some people will not like it. Some people, however, will think it's awesome. So you'll know pretty quickly on if you're the kind of person who's going to be into it, or if you're the kind of person who's going to be freaked out and run.
Right.
So, you know, I would say it's been a very good year so far. It really has. And, and once again, it comes down to depth more than anything else is, you know, there may only be four or five things that I would call great or awesome, or, you know, A plus, four stars, whatever. But there are so many things that I would say are A minus or 3.5 stars, or, you know, just in that really, really good category.
Yeah, agreed. Now, in the world of bad, I'm including Maya and Marty, which I watched every single episode simply because I love both of them, and I loved every guest star that they had on, but I just found it lacking every single time.
Okay, before you continue,
yeah,
you don't think it got better? Because a lot of people, and I haven't had the chance to watch it, a lot of people swore it got better by the end, and I was saw enough people comment on that I was like, okay, fine. I've got to go and watch it. Did you say no?
No. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it started out so bad that if it got better, and maybe it did incrementally, I still wouldn't recommend people watch it.
I understand, and really, in this day and age, you can't start that badly. You have to come out with more potential in the first week or two if you want people to stick around, and this one did not, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, so what else you got in your bag?
The two music shows on HBO, I gave Vinyl a much longer chance than most people did, and eventually I gave up on it. Two episodes into Roadies, I turned it off. Roadies is so bad, it makes Vinyl look like The Wire. I thought Roadies was horrendous.
Now, two things on that one. A, I like the pilot of Roadies.
Did you really? Oh.
It is Cameron Crowe doing sort of Cameron Crowe verging on parody, but I bought it because I like Cameron Crowe. On the other hand, the second episode was not good, and if you skipped out after the second episode, the third episode was unbearable. The third episode was so horrible, and the shocking thing about the third episode, beyond just how utterly tone-deaf it was that it was Cameron Crowe writing and directing it, and that left me really bummed.
You know, Cameron Crowe has been on the skids lately, and I thought Roadies was going to get him back in. I mean, I'm one of the few people on the planet that liked the Matt Damon Gets a Zoo movie. I'm one of the few people on the planet.
It was cute. I'm not going to go better than cute, but it was absolutely cute.
But I hated Aloha, and I'm trying to remember. I mean, he's been on this downward, like, skid for a while. And Elizabethtown, I can't stand. And then I thought, okay, well, he's going to go back to what he knows. When I saw the trailers for Rhodey, great cast. It's Cameron Crowe. I was so excited. After the first episode, I had to pick my jaw up off the floor. I really did. I was like,
I thought it was like ultra condensed Cameron Crowe-iness, and it was very much on the nose and sort of heavy handed and clunky, but it worked for me. Then it stopped working by the next episode.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I didn't watch the third episode. I gotta tell you. So, what else would you fall under the bad category?
Well, I will never miss an opportunity to tear into Fuller House, which was pretty much a cultural nadir, a cultural nadir, however you want to pronounce
it. Yeah.
Fine word spelled N-A-D-I-R. That's what Fuller House was.
Uh-huh.
Just utterly dismal and embarrassing for all involved, except no one's actually embarrassed because basically they did it for the fans. And the fans love it, and it's a huge hit, even though no one's going to say how it does. Yeah, shamefully bad. Let's see, what else? If I'm going to praise a bunch of Netflix, I might as well insult a bunch of Netflix. Flaked was about as empty and vapid as anything Netflix has ever done. It was not just a comedy without laughs. It was a comedy without laughs, but with feigned profundity. It was leaden and very bad. And it's a good thing that that I have endless reserves of love for Will Arnett, thanks to BoJack Horseman.
Right.
Not going to hold Blake against him. And I understand why he had to get it out of his system. That was bad. And then at the bottom of the barrel, on all levels, is CBS's Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, just utter wreck and kind of representative of the worst kind of American thinking circa 2016. It's the kind of show that could be projected on the screen at the RNC this week.
Yeah, I was just kind of I never watched it, but every time you talked about it or I read about it, I was kind of astounded as to what was the content of that show. So
and yet it was renewed. So so that's part of what CBS wants its brand to be: utter embarrassing dreck, xenophobia, racism up the wazoo, and just badly told drama to boot.
Okay. All right. Dan, hang on. We'll go to a much safer and better place after this, okay? Because we're going to talk about Stranger Things. All right. Hold on. Dan Feinberg is here, and we're going to come back after the news, and we are going to talk about a really, really terrific Netflix show called Stranger Things. We'll tell you all about that after the news here on WGN. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Good morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. as we are every weekday morning. It's Thursday. Triple Play Thursday will be coming up. We're going to have some live music in studio. Would Esmeralda buy that? Get ready to chime in on that. We've got that coming up as well. But right now we're talking to Dan Feinberg. Dan is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And, he joins us every couple of weeks to talk TV. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. Let's get into Stranger Things on Netflix. Watched the whole thing in two sittings. And I had no idea who the Duffer Brothers were. Now I love them. Can you explain to me who the Duffer Brothers are?
I really can't. They worked on the first season of Wayward Pines. They did a couple little indie short horror films and I believe a indie feature horror film that got barely any release. But this is who the Duffers are. They are two guys clearly raised on Stephen King, Steven Spielberg, John Carpenter, and frankly, all of the things that I was raised on in the early to mid 80s. And so Stranger Things spoke my language. It spoke your language, I assume. And I think there are a bunch of people whose language it speaks very fluently.
I thought it was just terrific. I really did. But we could, briefly, if you want to give people, just tantalize people a little bit with what the plot is.
It's hard to explain. It begins with an escape from a government research facility. We don't see what escapes. And then coming home from playing Dungeons and Dragons with friends, a small boy is abducted by something. The community thinks he's lost or gone, but his ragtag group of friends, they believe that they can find him, and they get surprising help in the form of of a young girl with a shaved head and the number 11 tattooed on her arm and some really, really unusual powers.
Right.
And it's E.T. with a little girl. It's Goonies with scientific exploration. It's Close Encounters of a Third Kind, but probably not extraterrestrial.
Right. Poltergeist.
It's very Poltergeist in places. Yeah. It's very The Thing in places.
Yep.
You just sit there with your bingo card and go, I got that one. I got that one. Let's see where that's pulled from.
Yeah.
Let's see where the font of this show came from. That's on all the Stephen King books I read
exactly
when I was a kid.
Right.
I know where this synthy soundtrack came from. It's totally John Carpenter.
Yep.
And you just sit there and you do that. And it also is just a really well done version of the thing it's paying homage to. So
yeah.
It could just be all references. It's not. It's a good story and a lot of references.
Yeah, it is. And it's also, like, really wonderful character work. Best thing Winona Ryder's done in a long time. She's really great in it. And so is, oh, God, I'm blanking on the guy who played Hopper, the sheriff.
That would be character actor David Harbour.
Yeah, awesome. Terrific. And a really interesting character with a nice arc. And I loved every one of these kids, particularly the girl who played 11. I thought was wonderful.
That would be Millie Brown.
Millie Brown, right.
Yes. She is so genuinely effective and good and in so many different ways beyond what she would need to be just to play the slightly odd, otherworldly, inexplicable girl with powers. She's better than she needs to be. She gives a lot of depth to the character.
She really does. And, I thought all the kids were great. And I, for all the reasons that you mentioned, I really liked it. And I think people who did watch those films from the 80s and they made a mark on them are going to enjoy it. But I really think even if you didn't, this is something that's going to grab you because the story itself is compelling and really well done and filled with surprises. Like, there were episodes where I'm like, I have no idea where this is going. And I love that Matthew Modine, we were talking about this the other night, love that Matthew Modine, to me, seems to be doing David Cronenberg. Reminded me very much of David Cronenberg.
I just got stuck on the assumption that he was basically doing Peter Coyote
right.
in E.T., that he was doing Keys, and that was, which, you know, is a perfectly fine thing to want to do.
Yep.
But I love what he's doing, and it's so good, and you get the 80s backdrop of everything that Winona Ryder did, of everything that Matthew Modine did.
Yep.
That just flows into it because of their presence there. It just adds to the layers of this.
Yeah, I watched all 8 episodes in 2 sittings. I loved it. I thought it was great. And the really crazy thing is, Dan, I started watching this the morning after I saw John Carpenter in concert. which, by the way, was magnificent. And it was just the timing of it. You know, like I'm like, you know, 12 hours out of a John Carpenter concert and I'm watching this. I'm like, oh, man, this is a fantastic weekend.
it does what it sets out to do so well because it loves those pieces of entertainment from the Duffer Brothers youth, from our youth. And it understands for the most part many of the reasons why we love them. I think it has some flaws if you poke around at it,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know that I need to poke around at it because I think it does what it does, and it does it entertainingly and spookily and so well cast,
yeah.
All of the actors, every single one of them.
I agree with you. Okay. Now, you know, since we're on Netflix, I haven't watched the new season. Well, is BoJack Horseman on yet, or did you see screeners of it?
Saw screeners, saw 12 episodes. It premieres on Friday, though, so
whenever
Netflix's calendar switches over, time zones and numbers get weird. But yes, I've seen all 12 episodes of the third season of BoJack Horseman.
And for people who might not know what BoJack Horseman is, I've watched both seasons and I love it. And I watched it because of you and Esmeralda, who works in the traffic with us here in the morning. Tell everybody what it is.
It is about a horse who lives in a version of Los Angeles that is populated by both humans and animals alike with nary a raised eyebrow. And he was the star of a Full House style, really, really crappy late 80s, early 90s sitcom called Horsin' Around. And since that time, things were not so good for BoJack. But in the last season, he finally got his dream project of a movie version of Secretariat put into production. And the third season, which premieres on Friday, finds BoJack facing the possibility of success and facing the possibility of becoming an Oscar contender for Secretariat and realizing that even success and even being an Oscar contender can't necessarily make you happy if you are a fundamentally unhappy and flawed person.
Or horse.
It is a show that is as in-depth and serious about its focus on depression and sadness and disconnection as any show on TV, and it's also a really hilarious Hollywood satire full of cute and adorable animals doing animal things that are also human things. It is a really great show, and for me, the third season continued an upward progression for it. I think that the third season is as good or better than the second.
That is such good news. Such good news. Tell everybody who's behind this show creatively.
It's Raphael Bob Wexberg, I believe, is the creator. Raphael Bob Wexberg. There we are. Is the creator, and he had done just little animation digital type stuff. I mean, he doesn't come from one of those sort of Simpsons, Family Guy, et cetera, backgrounds, which is, of course, probably why this works so well. The art comes from Lisa Hanawalt, and, this is Netflix's attempt to do an adult animated show, and it sort of lures you in, because the first few episodes really are mostly just the Hollywood satire and the, oh, look, cute animals, and the, oh, here are funny celebrity voices being funny. So it's Will Arnett as the main character. You've got Aaron Paul as the slacker who basically just lives in Bojack's house. You have Amy Sedaris as Princess Caroline, the cat who's Bojack's agent. Alison Brie voices Diane Nguyen, who is a author who is going to write a book about Bojack. You have Paul F. Tompkins as a dog who was also on a 80s, 90s sitcom named Mr. Peanut Butter. And so it's all of those, ha, 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 that's a little bit cutesy, that's a little bit cutesy, that's a little bit cutesy. And then you progress and you progress and you go, ooh, that's dark, that's painful, but still funny. And you go back and forth. And each of the first two seasons, and it continues into the third, have had episodes that are absolutely crushing.
Yeah.
Just absolutely crushing. The penultimate episode of both of the first two seasons, I would point to as the moments where you can see just how, Bojack can jab at a raw wound. And perhaps because there's so much animal-based hilarity, it gets away with it, and it hurts, but it hurts in a way that you're still giggling.
Yeah.
And it's just a great show.
It went to places that I didn't think it was going to go to. It really did. And I think it's great. I'm looking forward to it. Now, you mentioned that this is Netflix attempt at sort of an adult animated series. Is F for Family going to come back?
It is. It took them a long time to renew it, and the first season was only 6 episodes,
yeah.
And then it took a solid 3 or 4 months before Netflix finally got around to renewing it. I think the second season is either 10 or 13. It's a longer run, and I believe they just finished recording on it, so they haven't yet announced when it will premiere. I would hope/assume probably spring, summer, fall of next year. These things don't go quickly.
So,
which is too bad. And hopefully they're already telling them to start getting writing on a hypothetical imaginary season 3, because the first season was really a very good show and a very funny show and a very textured look at growing up in the 70s. And it did that very, very well. And it was one of the sort of somewhat under the radar Netflix shows. They have the big things that they want to make sure you know about, and then they have the littler things that they hope people find out about gradually. And that was one of those find out about it gradually shows. But most people I know who watched that first season really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I loved it. And I'm 51, and so I grew up in the 70s. I was like the age of probably the youngest kid when that show took place. And my friend, who's exactly the same age as I am, he lives in LA now, because that happens So he lives in L.A. now. And we share a very, very common sense of comedy. We wrote a lot of stuff together, plays here, comedy plays here in Chicago years ago. And he messaged me and said, look, you have to watch this show, this F for Family. You've got to watch it. And so on his recommendation, I'd never heard of it. And on his recommendation, I watched it. And, if you know, I watched the whole thing. I just in one sitting. And I just thought it was hilarious, and I identified with everything, and I'm glad it's coming back. I was concerned. I thought maybe, you know, since nobody really watched it, I thought it wouldn't come back, but I'm glad to hear that it will.
I think that there have been, you know, there are these sort of random BS services that give vague indications of people maybe or maybe not watching these Netflix shows. You know, that there actually was a Nielsen report that had some of the numbers for Orange is the New Black that were real. But everything else is coming from random systems, like I think it's Symphony, which does this weird thing where if your phone is activated, it picks up the audio signals from your TV if you're playing things, and it's intrusive and kind of terrifying.
Wow. Whoa.
It's strange, but it's given some people who choose to believe this very, very questionable set of statistics an idea of maybe who's watching these shows. And those numbers, which are completely fake and illusory, so let's not pretend as if they're real, those numbers point to good young adult demos for F's for Family.
Okay.
So, you know, if you put any stock in that, some people are watching, maybe.
Okay, well, I'm glad it's coming back. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us, and we're talking TV as we do every couple of weeks. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter. You can read his stuff there. We have a link on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NickDShow, one of the many reasons why you should like us right now. And you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. More TV talk is coming up. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Talk and text 312-981-7200. Get your Triple Play Thursday requests in, 312-981-7200. And much more coming up. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, joins me to talk TV. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much.
On yesterday's show, we did a full tribute to Gary Marshall. And so a big loss in the world of television comedy for sure. And you wrote a piece about Gary Marshall?
I did. Because this was a sad one, and this was a sad one that felt honestly more personal. And even though I think I've probably exchanged 5 words with Gary Marshall over the years, because he would show up at TCA press tour periodically, and every time he did, it was like sitting down and, you know, just sitting down at the feet of your grandfather or your uncle and saying, tell me stories.
Yeah.
You know, tell me the awesomest stories about this awesome world and these awesome people you knew. And he was a guy who always was happy to do that and told the best stories. And so it's not surprising that so many of the stories he told, you know, for money, he told as well as he did, and that they resonated as well as they did with just so many generations. And yeah, this one hurt a little because, you know, Gary Marshall didn't get the acclaim of like a Gary Shandling, you know, where Gary Shandling was revered as a genius. You know, Norman Lear, long may he live, is revered as a genius. Gary Marshall, it feels like it's a more complicated response because of lots of celebrity-studded rom-coms associated with different holidays.
Right.
So, you know, we kind of associate him with those things. But you look at that run of 70 shows from The Odd Couple to Happy Days to Laverne and Shirley to Mork and Mindy. And then you look at some of the movies that didn't involve stars and celebrating holidays and rom-coms, but, you know, Beaches, say what you will about it, that is a movie that works completely on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a great movie or not, no, it's not. But that is a movie that wants you to be a weeping mess at the end of it, and it succeeds. And I don't even think it succeeds in a way that is as maudlin as, I don't know, something like Pay It Forward, you know, just
right.
To use a hypothetical example of a maudlin movie where I want to beat everyone up
right.
Who was associated with it.
Right.
You don't want to do that with Beaches. You just want to offer them a handkerchief and say, I'm sorry, that's bad. Pretty Woman, as you know, it is saccharine. It is an absurdist fairy tale about the hottest prostitute in the world and the nicest prostitute buying millionaire in the world. And, you know, there are all those stories about the original ending of the movie and all of that, an ending that would have had nothing to do with an ending that Gary Marshall wanted to make. But that is a movie that works on its own terms. And then, as I wrote about last night, a couple places, I just love The Flamingo Kid.
Me too.
I think The Flamingo Kid is an unqualified great movie, and I think it is his great movie.
I agree with you 100%. The Flamingo Kid is a wonderful, wonderful movie. We talked about that yesterday when we did our tribute to Gary Marshall, and we talked about the impact that he made. We got to hear him talk about what it was like to first work with Robin Williams and how his 80-year-old cameraman couldn't follow him. he just told this great story. He's like, I don't know, I couldn't move the camera. He didn't come past here. I didn't get any of that. Like, it was just this great story he told. There was a great audio that we played of Cindy Williams and Penny Marshall talking about working with him. And then we talked about like his appearances in things because he was so funny. Like in Soap Dish, he's hysterical in Soap Dish. And of course, we played the entire scene from Lost in America, which is one of the funniest scenes ever committed to film, in my opinion. And he's hysterical in that. And so a huge loss, you know. Those three shows were like the top shows. Those three at one time, Happy Days, Mork and Mindy, Laverne and Shirley, were like the number one comedies, you know, on TV. I saw footage of him that we were looking up, you know, before the show yesterday morning, of him actually roller skating between productions. Like, he would put on roller skates, and roller skate, he'd go over to Mork and Mindy's set, and he basically ran Paramount's TV division at that point. And he was an amazing, amazing guy. And we played the audio from The Odd Couple when they were on Password, which is one of my favorite episodes ever. So, yeah, he was an amazing guy. And I think you're right about that. Like, he doesn't have the prestige reputation that the men that you mentioned have. But he deserves, you know, to be recognized as much as those guys.
I just think that the comedy went a different way. And, you know, comedy went ironic. And whether you blame or credit, because it's not really blame, it's whether you credit David Letterman and SNL and all of the things that followed that. There has been a distancing an approach to comedy where it's like, okay, we're going to comment on things. But if you look at Happy Days, it was not a distanced approach to the 50s and 60s. It was not a, oh, we're going to comment on that. It was, we're going to embrace this, and we're going to embrace this unironically and earnestly and find the humor that comes from the warmth of that embrace. And you couldn't do that today. You wouldn't be able to walk into a room with a network executive and say, I'm making a show about a family in the 50s where they really mostly love each other, and it's called Happy Days, and the title is not ironic.
Right.
And you couldn't do it. Yeah. And he did it, and I understand why what he did is not on the same wavelength as what we think of today as prestige comedy. It's not Dirty Rock. It's not Veep. That's not what the attitude is. But it's not like, you know, Gary Marshall couldn't understand that sensibility. You know, there's a reason why Albert Brooks wanted to work with Gary Marshall. There's a reason why Louis C.K. brought him in to be the head of CBS on Louis.
Yep.
You know, it's because even though the stuff he made maybe wasn't edgy, everyone understood that it's not that Gary Marshall couldn't have done edgy if he wanted to. It's just not what he wanted to do. It's
but
not the stories he wanted to tell.
I got to say, he did do edgy, as edgy as he's ever gotten, with Young Doctors in Love, which, you know, we played one clip yesterday, and it was the only clip that we could play on the radio from that film. And so many young, you know, comedians who went on to superstardom in that. And you know, Michael Richards is in it, and the late, great Taylor Negron is in it. It was Sean Young early on, Michael McKean, the great Harry Dean Stanton is in that film. And I don't know, I look back at that movie, and that's an R-rated, you know, sort of Airplane-inspired comedy, and he pulled that off, I think, very well.
Yeah, and it's funny, because if you look at subsequent movies, he did very little of that, but certainly the talent spotting from that movie, it was everywhere. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
He made Henry Winkler into a star. He found a way, to, as you say, to actually capture what it was that Robin Williams could do of capturing it on film.
Yep.
And that was not easy. That was not something that just anyone could have done at that moment. He said, here is an unchannelable comedian, and I have channeled this person for 3 years.
Absolutely
four
right.
Years.
Absolutely right.
And that's remarkable. And, you know, Julia Roberts. Yes, Julia Roberts had done other things before that. And, yes, she had proven that she was a beautiful young actress, et cetera. But, you know, without her reaction to Richard Gere closing the jewelry box.
Right.
You know, that doesn't make her into a star. You know, without that, she isn't who she is.
Right.
But that moment and that movie make her a star.
That's
so,
right.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, and you can read about Dan's thoughts on Gary Marshall at The Hollywood Reporter, and you can check it out at The Fine Print, which is linked on our Facebook page. Dan, hang on. We got a break here for the news. When we come back, I want to jump into some of your Take Me to the Pilots, okay?
Sure.
All right. Hold on a second. Dan Feinberg is here. We got to take a break. We got the news coming up, and afterwards, Dan will give you a preview on some of the pilots that he's seen for the new fall season coming up right here on WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome to Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to have some live music coming up in just a few minutes. After 4, we are going to play another round of Would Esmeralda Buy That? Here on a Thursday morning. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected. My guest right now is Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can again follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, FIEN. And we're talking about TV. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about, well, first of all, explain to everybody who might not know exactly what your Take Me to the Pilots is. They're not necessarily reviews. But they're like notes and things that you take while you're watching pilots.
Exactly. They are not my fully thought out, fully considered reactions to pilots, and therefore they are not reviews because pilots change and actors come and go, things get rewritten, et cetera. But this is kind of the gut reaction to watching the pilots as I am doing now as we get closer to fall, and it's just different layers of thinking about things. So this is my first layer of thoughts, and then September will roll around and full reviews will come along.
Okay. All right, well, let's talk about a few of these. Let's go with one that I'm kind of interested in, and that is CBS's Bull. Let's talk about your thoughts on that.
Why, pray tell, are you kind of interested in that one, Nick?
I think it's because I watch Big Brother. And I just keep seeing commercials for it, and somehow I've become intrigued. And, you know, when you watch Big Brother 3 nights a week, well, 4 nights this week, because they're going to have the BB battle back on tomorrow night. but, you see commercials for all the CBS stuff. And Bull, for some reason, I don't know why, but it kind of intrigued me.
That's the one that's sticking for you.
Yeah.
Then let me tell you, as a first response, it's not very good. Mm. It's got a kind of interesting premise, which is basically it's very loosely based on Dr. Phil's period as a jury consultant. And Dr. Phil is being played by Michael Weatherly, who doesn't look like Dr. Phil or talk like Dr. Phil or really behave in any way like Dr. Phil, because it's a modern show, and so Dr. Phil never did this job in a modern context.
And where would people know Michael Weatherly from?
He is the star of NCIS.
Right.
Or was one of the stars of NCIS. He left NCIS, and CBS quickly put him in a pilot, and because he was one of the stars of the network's biggest hit, they are fairly confident that they've got another hit on their hands. Unfortunately, it's one of those shows about people who are really smart that is really, really dumb about explaining and showing how they're really smart. And, it makes you appreciate a show like A House or something where they actually really smartly illustrated, at least for a number of years, how the mind of a brilliant person would function in a world of people who were smart but not brilliant. And this, unfortunately, is a really dumb way of showing how a brilliant person would react in a world full of idiots, basically.
Okay.
And unfortunately, it's pretty grating and not really all that entertaining, unfortunately. But, you know, people who like Michael Weatherly probably will be fine with him here. And I think that It feels like a CBS show in many ways, and thus I would expect it to do okay, probably.
All right. You wrote Take Me to the Pilots for two TV shows that are being rebooted from movies. You got Frequency and you got Lethal Weapon. I guess Frequency is the stranger of the two, that they would make a TV series out of Frequency, and it's on the CW. Tell us your thoughts on that.
It is not entirely intuitive process, because they changed the gender of the main character. So the Jim Caviezel character, which character was the one who was in the past and which one was the present in the movie?
Quaid was in the past.
Okay. So the past.
I can't believe I remembered that.
My problem is I just got them confused in my mind and I couldn't clear out which one was past or which one was present.
Right.
So it's Jim Caviezel who's in the present, and his character has been made into a young woman now, played by Peyton List, who people would recognize probably most frequently as Jane Sterling from Mad Men. And it has also closed down the gap between the generations that the ham radio can brave. So rather than being 30 years like it was in the movie, it's 20. And thus, there's a lot of nostalgia for 1996, which kind of hurt me and mostly made me feel old. So, but it's not bad. I've liked Peyton List in things before, and I think that it's kind of cool that she's getting a chance to be a leading lady and a proactive, strong, smart, move the plot along leading lady. So that's cool in CWE. And then there are so many time travel shows this fall and spring. You've got this, you've got Timeless on NBC, you've got Time After Time on ABC. And so, if you're kind of amused by the butterfly effect version of time travel, there's some amusing stuff. I don't know how it works as a weekly show. I really don't. It's either it's just going to be a bunch of going back and forth on the ham radio, using the ham radio to solve past crimes, which feels like a cheat to me and will, again, constantly change time, or else I don't know. But I'm curious. It could work. On the other hand, Lethal Weapon, it does make sense as a TV show. It's basically mismatched bickering cops partners solving crime on a weekly basis. That's pretty easy if that's all you think that the Lethal Weapon movies were when they were good. So my response to it, at least initially, is that it's a lot more like Lethal Weapon 3 and 4 and a lot less like Lethal Weapon 1 and 2.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, now, what about Speechless with Minnie Driver? That's a pilot that you also wrote about.
I did, and I like it. It's the premise of the show. I mean, basically, it's another of ABC's well-done family sitcoms with quirks, single cam sitcoms with quirks. And so the ABC has a lot of those, from Fresh Off the Boat to Modern Family to Blackish, etc. And this is a good tonal match with that. The twist is that she has that she has three kids, one of whom is a special needs child. He has cerebral palsy, I believe, and he's also a smart and funny character. He just happens to be wheelchair-bound and unable to talk. So that is basically sort of where a lot of the humor comes from. But it's mostly another one of those, here's our close-knit but also dysfunctional family against the world kind of thing. And ABC does this well, and no one else does it well. So it's encouraging to see that whatever the magic formula is that ABC has, it mostly seems to be working here. Minnie Driver is the mother, and you look at ABC's sort of strong tiger moms, from Constance Wu on Fresh Off the Boat to Tracy Ellis Ross on Blackish to Wendy McClellan Covey on Goldberg's. Minnie Driver's playing another one of those. And in a good way, I mean, and also she gets to be British, which is a tremendous relief, because when she's British, Minnie Driver is really, really charming and fun to watch.
Yeah.
Sometimes when she's American, she's less so, but, as happens so often with actors trading in their natural accent.
And that is, that's a half an hour then.
It's a half hour single cam. I think ABC is pretty high on it. I think they think that it's both progressive, which it is, but also just solid and good, which it is. You know, the pilot does not make me bust my gut laughing or anything, but that's tough to do in a pilot. What it does is it establishes a few characters who seem interesting and fresh and a world that seems somewhat different. So I can be there for that.
Okay. I wanted to mention to you that I am really, really loving The Night Of.
Very good.
Oh, it's so good. And, you know, the pilot of it was one of the most compelling and suspenseful things I've seen on TV in a very, very long time. And I love the second episode, and I cannot wait for the third. How many of it have you seen? Oh, you saw seven of the eight, right? Or
seven of the eight, and something started bothering me by the sixth and seventh episodes, and you know, not bothering me so much that I checked out on the show by any means, but just, you know, little things that were in the back of my throat, and you know, causing an itch somewhere. But no, it's a very good show, and it's a very well acted show, and it's another show like, amusingly, but not in any way similar, like Stranger Things, where it has a few character actors who you absolutely totally know. So John Turturro is kind of the Winona Ryder of it to some degree.
Yeah.
But it's just got this great cast, and even the people who you don't know and you don't recognize are fantastic, and the people who you do know and recognize are also.
Yeah. And in the pilot, in the first episode, Turturro doesn't show up till the last 5 minutes. And but I love his entrance. I love the way his character just shows up and how he gets involved. And from that moment, I knew that this was going to be like a really great role for Turturro just during the last, you know, 10 minutes of the pilot.
It is, I would say, probably his best, certainly his best lead role in a long time, because he, you know, he just doesn't get offered that many lead roles, and here he is, and he is the lead, but he's the lead as part of an ensemble, sort of a first among equals, I guess, kind of thing. But yes, he's great, and subsequent episodes spend much time on his itchy feet.
Yeah, that's great. Anyway, it's called The Night Of. It's on HBO on Sunday nights, and it's a really, really, really terrific show, which is Steve Zaillian and why am I blanking on?
Richard Price,
right, yeah. And it's just a great piece of work, and it's a lot of fun to watch. Before we let you go, I saw that you tweeted out that you enjoyed Ghostbusters. So did I. I laughed my butt off during that movie.
I didn't laugh my butt off, but I laughed enough, and I want to see the next movie. I mean, this to me did feel like it bent over a little bit backwards to be establishing this new group, and of course it would. That's what it has to do. Now give me the next movie. That's what I'm ready for, to see the further adventures where we don't need to establish anything, where we can just drop these characters who I like already now to a new world.
It's funny because I saw the film with my parents, and my father never watches SNL. He just doesn't watch SNL. He leans over to me after Kate McKinnon's second scene, and he goes, "Who is that?" I said, "That's Kate McKinnon. She's on SNL." He goes, "She is funny." and so I subsequently sent a few clips to my father from SNL. The first one I sent him, the alien abduction, the first time they did the alien abduction thing with Ryan Gosling. And my dad has now become a card-carrying president of the Kate McKinnon fan club. I just thought, my 74-year-old dad is the biggest fan of Kate McKinnon on the planet right now.
She is very funny, and you could probably send him clips for weeks.
Oh, yeah. So, no. After I sent him the alien clip, I sent him that, and I sent him one of the Olga bits from Weekend Update.
Bear with me.
and then I think he just started going YouTube nuts. You know what I mean? Like, he was just like, all right, that's it, more Kate McKinnon. So,
hey, what a fun rabbit hole to go down.
I agree. All right, now I understand that you've got your big event coming up.
Indeed, the Television Critics Association press tour, which we do every January and July into August, begins next week. So that'll begin 17 days of network and cable and streaming services presenting all of their fall and early winter shows to 200 to 300 increasingly grouchy television critics.
Well, listen, I hope we can get you on in a couple of weeks for your regular visit. I know you'll be in the middle of it, but we really hope we can get a report from you from there.
Oh, looking forward to it.
Okay. All right, Dan, thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure.
All right, take care. Dan Feinberg, love the guy. He is from The Hollywood Reporter, TV critic. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN.